This week on Retronauts, go ahead and destroy the financial district, Godzilla. Make the people happy. Hello, welcome to Retronauts. I'm your host, Kevin Bunch. Today we are not actually talking about Godzilla directly, although he does factor in. I want to talk about an interesting book that came out a month and a half ago as of this recording. It's called Building SimCity, How to Put the World in a Machine. It was released through MIT Press, and it delves into the history and design of SimCity, but moreover, and more interestingly to me, it contextualizes it in a way that I think may be interesting and surprising to readers as well. And I've got a special guest joining me for this book talk, and that's the author.
Yeah, so my name is Chaim Ginkel. Thanks for having me on the program, Kevin. I'm excited to talk to you about it. Maybe we can also talk about water rights and water quality at some point, too.
We were discussing that a little bit before we started recording. We have a lot of thoughts about water rights, as it turns out.
But, which is relevant to SimCity, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it was designed out in California, a famously dry region, so.
Yeah, land management.
Yeah. So, I guess my first question is, why SimCity? What interested you in, well, actually, let me back up a little bit before that. What is your book about in your own words?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think that I struggled a lot with how to the book was a lot longer, and I kept making it shorter and shorter to hit the word count contract and for like readability. And then it was really hard to get it down to like one line and get to like a title and then like a one paragraph blurb. But what it is it's a deep dive into SimCity, and it like looks at how SimCity works, but it's really like the successive zoom out of like SimCity. What's the context of SimCity, Maxis? Where did it come from? Where did the ideas come from? So it's sort of, and in that way, it's also a sort of journey into the history of computer simulation and simulation more broadly. So it's like this really juicy case study, I think, about one game, but also sort of this historical context, like a fractal.
Yeah, and that really was fascinating to me when I was reading it, because I went into it, I knew obviously from the title it was about SimCity, and I knew just from reading the materials around it that it sort of delves into where SimCity came from. But actually, like going through it was really interesting, because all of the ideas you're laying out in the first like half of the book, because the first half of the book isn't necessarily about SimCity, it's about everything that leads up to SimCity, and then like you were able to loop it all into SimCity in a way that made a lot of sense, because you point out, oh, this is what Will Wright looked at when he was putting together like his initial idea for SimCity. Like, these were the materials that inspired him in specific ways, and what ways were those? So it's really like interesting how it's all put together. So I think that does lead into the question of like, why SimCity specifically? Like, what interested you in this particular topic?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that there's a couple ways to answer it. I think one is just that growing up, I was born in 1980. I remember playing a pirated copy of SimCity and died probably like night by when I was like 10, like around just when it came out. And it was just like one of these many weird things that we got a hold of. And played on the computer, and it was just really, like a lot of other people was captivated by it. Part of it was just sort of like wanting to understand like the mystique of SimCity, which I think SimCity did really have this hold on, like it really captured the attention of computer gamers, but it also captured the attention of a lot of other people, like complexity scientists and urban planners and the general public in a way that I don't think had really happened before with a simulation game or a computer game. And then, of course, I had worked with Will Wright. I started my career working with him on Spore as an intern initially. And so, I think Will's amazing, and I idolize him. And so part of it was sort of having talked to him a lot about the design of it and knowing something about it. But I think that the reason why I converge on SimCity in particular was when I did my dissertation research at UC Santa Cruz, I initially came in wanting to do like the history of like 10 different games. I think it was initially the idea that I came into. My advisors were like, you know, you really should just focus on one thing. And I think that somewhere I have to like go look at my emails or notes or something, but it's somewhere I ended up sort of converging on SimCity. I think it was partially because it was open source. At that point, EA had open sourced it. And so we could study the source code, which was very exciting to us, I think, because, you know, they were pushing me to do this like software studies kind of work that looks both that looks at the technical design of software. So it was like a really juicy opportunity as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I do feel like SimCity did hook a lot of people. I remember picking it up with the Super Nintendo release, which I feel like might have been the, you know, the best selling version of the game and maybe one of the more familiar ones for folks. But like you touch into like the PC versions a lot more in depth, obviously, because that's the version that's open source. And I did think that was interesting as someone who hasn't really messed with the PC versions of SimCity. Because for me, it's like, okay, I can see like what is identical to what I came up with or what I came up playing rather and what was originally intended or like planned and why it was that way. You know, you talk about how it started as a Commodore 64 game originally and sort of the like reasoning behind that particular platform and its limitations and how those affected SimCity even when it expanded out to other systems and computers. And I thought that was really interesting. Is there any particular part of SimCity that like really grabbed you when you were younger? Do you remember?
Gosh, I mean, I remember playing the Super Nintendo version too. Yeah, I guess we pirated the Mac version, and then we definitely bought on the Super Nintendo, which was like at that point probably. I think about the Commodore 64 to Mac and PC to Nintendo. It's like the Nintendo is kind of gets on this trajectory of getting more and more juicy and user friendly and fun in a sense, and I think that. Yeah, what hooked me on it? I don't know. I think maybe it was like the beginning to, it was the world, I think, and getting to play with this living world, you know? And it's kind of incredible that Will got all that to run on the computer. You know, that's kind of like, I guess that's one of the things that's fascinating about SimCity is how all of this stuff seems to be, it's an incredible illusion. And it's got this multitasking, multi-threading on the Mac, also like multitasking operating system in a sense inside that's juggling all this stuff. And so on the C64, on the Commodore 64, Will sort of manages to get the right abstractions to get the core of the system working there. And then once it gets onto the Mac can kind of blossom and kind of get graphically richer and use the graphical user interface and become easier to use. And then the Super Nintendo version, like Miyamoto and his team are collaborating with Will Wright, you know, like one of the best game designers in the world, you know, it's like, let me take your thing and make it better, you know, and work with you on it. So I don't think I answered your question. I just kind of riffed on what you were saying. Yeah. Okay.
It's a very free form discussion. I feel.
Okay. Great. Okay. Cool.
We're not on fresh air today.
Okay, great.
So I do want to also back up a little bit because you mentioned that you had worked on Spore a bit with Will Wright, and I think it's your background is very unique coming into this particular game. Like, you know, what led you from like game design to academia to writing this book, and like,
yeah,
how'd that all come together?
Yeah, it's a great yeah. Well, let's see, I came to. I guess it's like, I guess it would be the question first is like, yeah, how did I go back and forth? Like, I remember when I finished my undergrad degree, I went to do a master's at Georgia Tech in digital media with Janet Murray, who had written Hamlet on the Holodeck, who was another idol of mine. And then in between the 2 years of that program, there was a required summer internship that you had to do, like an internship like in industry somewhere. So there was already, I guess, at that, this kind of like academic industry sort of hybridization in a sense. And I was like, I don't really want to games. I was like, kind of like not really interested in games, unless of course it was with like Maxis, right? It was kind of like, which is like an impossible thing to do. And I was just, I love games. And I just didn't really want to work in games. I don't know. Like, I had very mixed feelings about it. And then at some point, this opportunity came up. Like, I'm very lucky. Janet got an email from a recruiter at EA saying that they were interested in an intern. Will, they were looking for an intern for Will Wright or something. And then Janet wrote me this letter. And then within like an hour or something, I had like this offer. It was just like, it was just like the right person in the right place at the right time. And so do this internship with Will, and it was just incredible. So I did this internship there, did some early prototyping on Spore. And when I finished the internship, they tried to get me to stay. I went back to finish my degree, and then I came back to work as a designer. So it was like, and I wasn't sure. I was like, I want to keep a foot in academia, which I kind of did, but didn't really. And then after EA, I then did some indie stuff for a bit, and then decided to go back to the academic route again. But yeah, I don't know. I kind of feel like I'd like to. I want to think about things. I don't want to make things. I don't know. That's the short way of putting it.
I feel that very strongly. And then of course you went and made a book, which I guess is very different from making a game. Although at this point you could easily speak to both of those.
Yeah, I mean that is part of the motivation for this book. Honestly, was that I think that after working on Spore, it was like a very It was an incredible experience, and it was also like a kind of like it was so different than how one would build something on one's. It's just like building something with a team at scale is like, and getting to be part of a company with an established discipline of making stuff is an incredible learning opportunity. And there's also this incredible amount of like drama is maybe too strong of a word, but there's a kind of like social, there's this kind of like, it's, you could make a TV series about making a game. And I guess people have done that because there's the Double Fine documentary, it's intense. And it's so, and I was interested in, I think after Spore sort of, I think I was trying to like process some of that experience. And I had there's this professor, Bart Simon at, Concordia, who was like, oh, you should check out, Bruno Latour's work. He's a very famous philosopher of science, and it's all about the sort of the social nature of technology. And I was like, oh, okay, I've heard his name has come up a bit, like, you know, but I was like, I'll see. And Bart recommended exactly the right book for me, which is about this French attempt to make this transportation system that just kind of falls apart and is written like a whodunit, like who killed this system. And some chapters are written from the perspective of the technology. It's like very like, you know, very eccentric. And that got me, and that to me was really helpful because it was like a bit like, oh, this is almost like therapy for the kind of like drama that I live through. This is like a new way for me to think about what I experienced, like with the drama of game development, of software development. So I'm very interested in the book, not just with SimCity and Maxis, like, but also the whole history of technology. Like, what is the social drama of development and invention? And also I had seen, like when I was interning with Will, he got out his old dusty Macintosh from the closet, and it was like, and I just remember he was like got it out, we like plugged it in, and there was like all the source code to like Simant and SimEarth and SimCity, and he was like proudly showing me the 3D rendering assembly for the SimEarth planet, and he was like, look, there's no branching statements here, it's really fast, like I wrote a program to generate this assembly code. It was like, so like, and I'd seen also all these prototypes of different Maxis things and early Sims prototypes, which I think is what he wanted to show me. And so I was sort of got a glimpse of the drama of the Sims development and how SimCity 2000 had references to the Sims inside the code, you know, which comes out like years before. So I was also very interested in kind of like making sense of that story. I kind of got like a glimpse of and the drama behind it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you do have a chapter in there about just like the broader history of Maxis and why it sort of, you know, fell apart on itself, because it's just a giant company of contradictions. And you talk a fair bit about, you know, these sort of follow-ups to SimCity, like SimEarth and SimAnt, which I grew up with and absolutely adored. I was the target audience for that one for sure. And of course, The Sims, in like, you're not, it's obviously not the focus of the book. The focus of the book's on SimCity, but you do talk about, like, sort of the process that went into The Sims. And I thought that was really fascinating because I know people have talked about it before, but you laid it out in a very, like, I'd like to say approachable method. Just like all the iterations it went through and how it informed all these other games Maxis was working on.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could write a whole book just on that. I mean, I think my prediction is that there'll be I know that at least one of the person who's working on a Maxis book, and I think that there will be multiple. I think there's room for multiple Maxis books, and there could be a whole book just on the development story of The Sims. I think that it's like, even that I am very aware of having left out a lot of details that I unearthed. But even getting clear on, like, the role of, like, the venture capitalists and what they wanted out of Maxis and how that also helped the development, you know, that both, like, helped the development of The Sims in a way by bringing mm-hmm. Will into contact with all of these leading people in computing and, you know, at the same time, like, also kind of push Maxis away from being more weird and experimental. I think that The Sims is, like, in a way that's the logical climax, you know, the culmination of the narrative, because it's like, it sort of draws all these, from all the different influences from AI, complexity science, architecture, and it needs this weird social context to come about, but then pulls the company apart.
Mm-hmm. And I appreciated that. I know EA has a certain reputation and frankly deserves a good chunk of it. But you do more or less credit EA to, like, making The Sims happen. And I know that is, like, historically what happened, but it's not the narrative you usually see around The Sims and Maxis. So I really appreciated that.
Yeah. I mean, I was surprised to learn just from talking to Will, just like, and other folks, like, just how much the EA executives were excited about The Sims. And they had there was even like a related competing product that was going on in Canada that was like another kind of people simulator. I mean, I was talking to someone else recently, another games veteran, who was saying that he had another project that was actually not unlike those as well around the same time, but they, you know, but Will made it work with EA's backing, right? And sometimes they were pulling against each other. Like, that also came through in the, you know, in the research that I did, but that's also that's the messy nature of development.
Yeah, it really seemed like an idea that, like, people had since computers were growing in complexity, but it really took a lot of work and, you know, almost a decade of development just to get something that, like, really made it all click. And I thought that was very fascinating to read, too. And, you know, the perspective of how SimCity factors into that, very cool, because, like, that was their cash cow for a long time.
I think it was the only cash cow. I think at some point Jeff Braun said to me something like, he, like, made this cop, we were, like, talking, it was like, it was all SimCity. there was never anything else. I mean, he's exaggerating a little bit, but yeah.
Sorry, Sim Golf and the other Sim Golf, that's completely different. Yeah, I do want to pull back in some of and talk about some of the earlier parts of the book. You know, sort of the pre-SimCity, pre-Maxis, pre-Will Wright materials. Because a lot of this was just really, like, obscure topics that I, you know, if I knew of them before reading this book, it was in very, very broad strokes. So, like, what was the research process for this stuff? How did you, like, come across it in the first place and dig it up?
Oh, this is a great question. It was, I would say, the short version, it was like torturous and took a very long time, but it was also a lot of fun. It was, how did I come across it? Well, let's see. So there's this whole chapter about Doreen Gary Nelson, this educator who spent her career doing this city building stuff with kids in classrooms. And that stuff, And she wrote the Max's Teacher Guides in the 90s, and I worked with Alan Kay at some point, and just to cut this incredible cast of collaborators, and the work is just so interesting. And she continues to do it to this day, and she's like in her mid-80s, and you know, she was watching the live Twitch interview that Will and I did last week, which is really sweet. It's like texting me for some technical support, you know, but she got in there.
Will was having a fun time on that live stream. You should check it out. I think it's VOD through ROMChip, Academic Journal. They have a Twitch channel.
So. Yeah. And it'll be on YouTube, I think, is where it's going to live. Yeah. I was like, just parenthetically, I was like, you know, Will's just spent his whole career. Everyone's been just like asking him all these questions, and I've been asking all these questions. So I think that I was just like, this will be, I just kind of let him have the reins, and I was a little scared, but it was fine. So the Dorian Nelson stuff. So initially, I think when I was working on Spore, there was a designer there, Claire Curtin, who was one of the Will's co-designers on The Sims. And she came onto Spore at some point. And she's super cool. And she had worked on Carmen Sandiego back in Bruderbund back in the day and just had this incredible career. And at some point, she just brought this little red book into the office and said, hey, Chaim, you should check this out. You'd probably be interested in this. And it was one of the first books that Dorian Nelson had published, like from the what year is it? Like the 70s, I think, maybe. Maybe it's the early 80s. And it's like Buckminster Fuller has written like a little endorsement inside of it, you know, and it's just like, and the photographs are incredible. It's just like these incredible pocket photographs of kids building things. And turns out that the photographs are copyright the office of Charles and Ray Eames, you know, one of the most legendary designers, you know, of the 20th century. And the book is just very approachable. And it was just talking about this process of getting kids to build these model cities. And it was just fascinating. And Claire said, yeah. And Doreen wrote some of the teacher guides for Max's products. And so I got it. So as I was writing the book, I sort of started researching Doreen's work more and more and interviewed her multiple times and went down and went to a teacher training. And, you know, it was many years, but eventually by the time I finished the book, I was like in her archive at UCLA, you know, having these old slides digitized, and I was like restoring them, you know, just kind of piecing together this story, which just got more and more, the more I pulled on it, the more interesting it got, you know. But it was kind of many years of just kind of poking away at that. Yeah,
this book doesn't seem like it was written very like overnight. It seems like it took a lot of hours and days and weeks, etc.
Yeah, I feel like I left a lot of, and then there's like things where I left a lot of the juiciest sort of things that I found on the editing floor, because I was like, this doesn't fit the sort of overarching narrative. Like I need to keep the cut. It can be too fractal, you know, like too many, like, oh, then there's the time that George Lucas wanted to merge LucasArts with Maxis, you know, which is like, I was like, and it's like a great story that Jeff Braun tells, but it's like one sentence footnote, you know, like endnote. Cause it's just not that important.
Yeah. Like it's cool, but like, how am I going to fit this in? I don't know. Figure that out for another day or let someone else sort it out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then a lot of the other chapters were like that too. The Cellular Automata chapter, it was like, I was a little frustrating because I'd be like, I think I got it now. And then I would just like fall through some other trap door of like, oh, I totally have to learn about this whole other subject, like von Neumann's self-replicating robot enterprise to even make sense of Cellular Automata. And then of course I have to figure out the context for that. And it's just like hard to, and then it was exciting to then figure out, oh, actually this is really helpful because now I can explain how and why the Santa Fe Institute, complexity scientists, and Will Wright get along so well later, like, and why Maxis's social network.
Yeah, for me, like, the Cellular Automata stuff was really fascinating because I do a lot of research into, like, 1970s, like, computers and games, so, like, Conway's Game of Life pops up constantly. Yeah. And seeing that sort of linkage into earlier renditions of the same concept, very much spoke to me. And you know, how you relate all of this stuff to like early computers and how those relate to like earlier tech than that, like the differential analyzers and the, you know, the electrical analogs and all that sort of fun stuff. Like that was a very fascinating through line to me to just like poke through and then see how it all comes together for SimCity, because, you know, SimCity, like, you delve into how the simulation for SimCity works and all the modeling, and it is pulling from, like, a lot of these threads.
I'm really, it's very gratified to hear that you like the whole sandwich, because I'm like, are there other readers out there who are going to like, you know, sort of appreciate the whole thing strung together? And so, yeah, it's very gratified to hear that you sound like you're the perfect target reader for this. Because I think at some point Will was reading it for the writing a blurb, and he wrote me, he was like, I'm halfway through it. And he's like, and this is so great. He's like, I think this was written just for me.
There you go. Well, I think you mentioned that it already like sold out its initial print run or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very modest print. I mean, I think we're talking like hundreds of copies at a time. So
it's MIT Press. But still, that does suggest it's not just Will Wright who's into this book. So.
Yeah, yeah.
And one thing from that sort of earlier framing period that I thought was interesting is that, like, you really had a real through line from, you know, you had the digital revolution and sort of how urban unrest in the 1960s over, you know, issues like redlining and segregation, like, really informed a lot of these early city modeling games and projects and research, and in turn how those impacted SimCity. So I'd be interested in hearing you talk about sort of that approach to putting this book together and sort of putting together the story of SimCity.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Henry Lowood, who's one of my advisors at Santa Cruz, he's a librarian at Stanford who does, he's like the dean of game history, as far as I can tell. He's like got a degree. He's like, or his original research was like, he's like history of technology guy who did like German forestry. He's like most cited academic papers about German forestry. It's an awesome paper. By the way, I highly recommend it. And Henry, when I did my defense, he was like, kind of like, you know, great job. You need more context, you know, like it's too kind of like internal. The history is like too sort of internal. And I really took that to heart. And as I read more and more history, I was like, oh, right, it's really about learning the social historical context. So that's one of these things that just kind of like pops out. I mean, you know, Will has been very clear about the influence of Jay Forrester's work, Urban Dynamics on SimCity, you know, one of the key influences. And you open up the beginning, you open up a copy of Urban Dynamics, and which I think is like $1,000 or something on eBay if you want to buy it now. But you open it up, and like the foreword is written by John Collins, the former mayor of Boston. And I think when I first read it, I didn't quite understand the historical context, but he's talking about like he and Jay Forrester are talking about the crisis of the cities. And like, what are they talking about? And it's like, well, because they're not really explicit about it, but what they're really talking about is like all of this urban unrest, you know, all of this you know, black people that are fed up with the discrimination and oppression that they're experiencing. And there's like the Watts riots. And I was just, so it's just fascinating. It's like this, and there's this moment, like the historian Jennifer Light has written a lot about this, about how like there was this whole moment during the, like at this time when there's this crisis brewing and all of these Cold War intellectuals get sort of attack this problem using their tools, right? These like analytical tools. And so Jay Forrester is like one guy, you know, he's like one example of this kind of larger movement of intellectuals that try to address this problem with computer modeling, right? Like, of course, right? That's what you use. That's like the hammer of the moment. And then I was also interested, and then also with Doreen Nelson's work, with her work with the kids in Los Angeles, like it also is prompted by the same thing. Like Los Angeles is experiencing these riots, and then the mayor organizes this commission of citizens to try to like look into the problem and try to address it, right? It's civics at work. And that's part of what sparks her interest. And she's a school teacher, and she starts getting interested in the city. And eventually, like, you know, she brings in her older brother's architect, Frank Gehry. She's like bringing her influences from architecture and design and she starts to address the crisis of the cities as well through her own city simulation work, right? And then she builds upon the work of other computer simulation people in her. So I don't know. I just was like struck by the how this crisis of the cities sort of triggered a whole wave of work that all, in a sense, is goes together.
Yeah, and you also note in there, you know, some of the critiques of like Forrester's work. You know, it's very top down. It doesn't take in, you know, race into account at all. It's only like class based, which, you know, I think that's reflected in SimCity as well, because SimCity, obviously the Sims are just points of data. They're not really anything.
Whereas
some of these other models that people were doing, you know, were taking sort of a bottom up approach, and you sort of describe the difference between those and how those work.
How you decide to cut up the world, abstract the world into your simulation matters a lot. So there's no race in SimCity and in Urban Dynamics because it didn't seem important, wasn't the important thing. But for Thomas Schelling's work on segregation at this around the same time, it's like all about race.
And you know that. And I know one of the things that people have lobbed as a critique against SimCity as like a teaching tool and not just a game is that, you know, you only have the values that are being brought into the model by the designers in this case. And, you know, he pulled some of this top-down approach from Forrester, who, again, did not take race into account. But at the same time, Will Wright, very big on public transit, and I think that is reflected in SimCity's simulation as well. So I think that's sort of an interesting angle to see, like pulling the curtain back a little bit.
Yeah, and part of why looking at the context of simulation and like who makes it, like why, like who's pegged, and especially when you get into, well, even for commercial work and non-commercial work, and who's paying the bills, like who's funding it, you know, like who's writing the grants, right? Like at some point, Forrester gets a grant from the Nixon administration because they like these resurgent conservatives like love Forrester's work. It like sort of fits a lot of their thinking, right? Mm-hmm. That you kind of like, cause his model, this Urban Dynamics model is like, sees taxation and like social welfare as kind of like it's like a bad idea. Like you just don't want to give people that are having a hard time any benefits because it's going to make the city more popular for you to get more people moving there who want the benefits and want the welfare, and it's going to bring the whole system down, right? So it's like this very, you know, like very conservative perspective, and so they give him money, right, to do the work.
Yeah. And you know, some of these other simulators, they were coming out of, you know, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society initiative. So, of course, they take their own approaches to it. So,
yes.
Which I think also comes up in the book as well.
Yeah.
I'd have to sift through and find the specific parts.
Well, Lyndon Johnson found it's under his administration that the National Endowment for the Arts, I think, is started, which is becomes the original funder of Dorian Nelson's work. And then Will's neighbor, Bruce Joffe, who turns out like lives around the corner from me here in Oakland, who is the urban planner that lived across the street from Will. Bruce had worked for like a housing and development program that Lyndon Johnson started, and he was very ideologically motivated in that work at that time, and then went on to do centralized city planning for, I think, like building like cities in Saudi Arabia or something like that. Like,
yeah,
kind of boom towns, I guess, or something.
You know, and SimCity's not just like the modeling and everything, all that is a big part of it, is that you also talk a lot about how approachable it is to play with SimCity and operate it. You know, and in that regard, you also delve into sort of the history of the basic computer language and some of the previous like GUI GUI arrangements that people had been coming up with at, you know, Apple and the like. And yeah. I think that's interesting as someone who's also very fascinated by like the Dartmouth College basic like creation.
Yes.
So did you get to talk to anyone who was involved with Dartmouth when you were putting this together, or did you just pull from materials?
I pulled from the... I looked, and what was really helpful, I looked at the... There's a series, the ACM has a series called The History of Programming Languages, and there was an amazing BASIC article in there by the creator, one of the creators of BASIC, that laid out their original process. And there's a book, really, really excellent book, everyone should go check out about BASIC. What is it called? It's Rankin. Joy Rankin is the author, and it's a People's History of Computing in the United States. And it's like this really great history of computing as like a folk culture and the importance of BASIC in there. She does a lot of great original research. And I mostly spoke to the person I spoke to, which was really delightful, was this guy, Bob Albrecht, who is most famous perhaps for hosting or organizing the Homebrew Computer Club, where Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak hung out, and he was an early proselytizer for BASIC. And I met him, I think I like just reached out to him and contacted him and drove out to visit him. And like, I live in Oakland. I was at Santa Cruz at the time, and he was in Livermore. And he was like, I don't know, in his 80s, I forget how old it was at the time, 80s or 90s. And he just like, was just this like teenage boy in his energy. And he was just so cool. And he just talked to me. We talked, and that was just it. And he had all these funny little historical tidbits. He told me, like, going to the first, what was that called in the 1970s, that playful, the new games movement. He went to the first one of these new game movement events, you know, where they had like played like Earthball and all these like non-competitive and competitive games. And and it's like, and he's like said, yeah, he's like, I think he said he went to Nolan Bushnell maybe and got some Atari arcade machines to bring out there. And it's like totally, it's like not when, you know, when you think about like, if you pictured, it's like, it's like the hills of Marin and these like hippies kind of rolling around and like, you know, playing with, you know, foam swords and things like that. But then there's like, it's like, oh, then there's like video games like around too. And Bob Albrecht is of course the guy who connected these worlds together, which makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm really fascinated by BASIC and like modifying programs as sort of a way to introduce people to programming, which, of course, that was sort of the whole idea with BASIC and with popularizing the language and DEC and, oh God, I'm blanking on his name now. David Ahl putting together the, like 101 BASIC computer games and, all that fun stuff. I got to talk with one of the early, like, Dartmouth BASIC, proponents, some years ago, and, like, he was also very enthusiastic, like, in his 90s, it was about how cool it was, like, programming games for it, for his classes and his students and everything. So, yeah, that was very interesting.
I mean, that's, like, one of my take. I don't really talk about this in the book, but one of my takeaways that other people have written about, I think, also is, like, I was, like, after studying all that, I was interested in computers as a creative medium, and these people doing all this work with BASIC and getting people to make games, I was like, and looking at what games are popular, the best-selling contemporary games, I was like, I think games, the medium of video games is making games. Like, it's about making games. Like, I think that's what it's about. It's about modding. It's about making your own. It's like, you're like, that's the story again and again and again that you see of like, oh, like Bill Budge gets Steve Wozniak's BASIC version of Breakout. And then he modifies it. And that's how he learns to program and start making his own games. And it's like that folk culture of game making and game playing seems the computers are somehow especially good at.
Yeah.
Well, if we choose.
Yeah. They could be good at lots of things, but let's talk about the thing that we want them to be good at in this particular instance. But yeah, like Bill Budge, he factors into your narrative as well. You know, the pinball construction set that he puts together was big influence on SimCity, which I never realized. Like, it never really occurred to me that, the user interface for pinball construction set would be a major influence on SimCity. But you lay out how it is, and that's very, like, surprising.
and even just, like, the idea that you could release this commercial game or toy, you know, really, that's,
yeah,
and that, like, that people would buy, you know. Nowadays it's kind of like, well, duh, you know, of course you're gonna buy a thing where you get to make stuff, and like a sandbox.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of anything that really predates that. And I'm struggling outside of, again, selling copies of BASIC, which, you know, that's a programming language. This is very different.
Right. It's like somehow at this threshold of commercial and non-commercial, right? Because what comes before is this folk culture of people sort of reproducing like space war over and over again. You know, it's like no one's buying it. It's like, it's just kind of getting reprogrammed, and the people are getting David Ault's book and, you know, like retyping in the programs and making up their own. So it's non-commercial. It's like a folk culture of game making, but that's like making that. Yeah.
I do find it interesting. It's off topic, but I talked with one of the people who wrote a game in David Ault's book, Bob Leadham. He wrote Super Star Trek, and he mentioned that he had been getting letters into the 2000s from people across the globe, like asking him for advice on modifying his program to work on whatever platform they were running BASIC on. And he would like give them some BASIC advice, you know, that no pun intended.
What's amazing is I would expect it to be at this point, like in JavaScript, the fact that it's like, how do I get this trend? Like in, like, how do I get this basic work I'm trying in BASIC? That's fascinating.
Yeah. So like, that's a very interesting topic to me. And just like people modifying games, learning to program, and then coming up with these sort of like design your own pinball machine, design your own city, design your own, Earth.
Right.
Design your own dollhouse. Like, it's all in like this interesting, not spectrum per se, a rich tapestry, we'll call it. So this is a book out of MIT Press. So it's a very like academic work, although I think it does also like read reasonably well for someone who's not in academia. So like, what aspects of the book do you think appeal to broader audiences, not just like people who are just very like academically interested in game history?
Well, I think that's kind of a that's like the big question that I'm kind of like on the edge of my seat with right now, honestly, because I'm just like, I don't know. Like, I'm like kind of interested to see like who does find it interesting and take it up, because I tried really hard to make it accessible to a really wide audience, but it's but then there are those Amazon reviews that are like, I bought this book and it's a, you know what, it's like a, yeah, I just like kind of spot is take all the worst reviews and put them together. It's kind of awesome.
They do love that.
Yeah.
It's always hard to tell like what is gonna like speak to someone until they actually read it. Obviously for me, I think it's just sort of the general simulation discussions, like I said, the cellular automata like developments and how that sort of feeds into SimCity. That was very fascinating to me. Well, I'd be interested in hearing what people who read the book think, if they want to let me know. Sure.
I'm just thinking I tried to make it as every chapter kind of standalone and be as readable as possible, just kind of like as a just like pacing kind of like, you know, standpoint, just kind of get as accessible as possible. Even if you don't know anything about how computers work or the history of computing or games or SimCity. But I don't know. I'm also a guy who really like basically reads nonfiction exclusively. And I'm currently on volume 4 of the Lyndon Johnson biography by Robert Caro. And I think it's just totally riveting. So I'm not the, I'm not the target audience. I'm, you know.
Yeah, I do like how you have everything split up into like, all right, here's the chapter on this topic, here's the chapter on this topic. And you have a whole chapter, a fairly lengthy one, on just how SimCity operates under the hood. That was like really like interesting to read through. How did you manage to pull that together? Or did you have to like dig through the source code, or did someone help you like walk through it?
That's a great question. So part of it was, I mean, obviously you get one sense for how it works by playing it. And then I've talked to Will about it quite a lot. and, you know, when I was working with him. So I kind of had a general sense of some of the design principles, but honestly, it was a lot of reading code, which, to come back to, you know, what I was talking about earlier, you know, my advisors at Santa Cruz really wanted me to do this like software studies dissertation and really like look at the code material. And that was part of why we settled on, part of what sort of pulled me towards SimCity, because the code was available, which is kind of a very cool opportunity. So, and I was trying to think about how because I make all these diagrams to explain, I was trying to think about the origin of that. I have to like look through my notes, but I think it may have been because I was reading the code and I was just trying to make sense of it. And so I just started like scribbling pictures. And I think it started with me just like mapping out the tile set. Like, what are the tiles? Like, what do they mean? Because like in the code, it's a lot of just like numbers, because it's just all in Will's head and people's head. And then Don Hopkins, who worked on the open sourcing, like in his versions of the code and his ports, there's more like mnemonics, you know, like but it's still not complete. But I sort of was kind of like, the first thing was like, I can't make sense of the code that's operating largely on these characters without knowing what they mean. So the first thing was kind of building this visual map. And then over time, I was like, it was a lot of back and forth of like, once I had more of the diagram built, I could understand more of the code and then I could make the diagram better. And that was really just, you know, I did that for the dissertation, and then that was done, and then I did the book. It was like a, you know, this 6x9 format, not the 8.5x11. So I had to like, I was like, well, I've got to like do like tighter visual design now, you know. So, and I, of course, my design skills were better at that point. So I was like, then also, I kind of iterated it more, and then also kind of needed to emphasize different things, you know, in the book, because I kind of, the story is more complete in the book than in the dissertation. So, yeah.
It's nice that you were able to pull from like work you'd already done to like sort of, I guess, save a little bit of time for the book.
Yeah. No, it's like, yeah, totally. I mean, this is like, and I don't think we said it, but it was like 10 years, over 10 years of like, you know, it's not full time 10 years, but this is like a 10 year plus project. So as part of it is like these things like have been iterated for a lot.
So did you get like approved for this with MIT Press, or were you just doing it on your own for like a chunk of that time?
First it was my PhD research, and that I finished that in 2016. And then I was kind of working on it in the background. And then I forget when I got the contract with MIT Press, but it definitely took a lot longer than we thought. Also, I had two kids while that was happening, and that slowed things down.
They do take up a lot of time.
Yeah, surprising. What making human beings is quite a lot of work, actually.
So you had to like put in your own comments for the code on what everything meant, or did the like source code that you come across, did it already have comments in there to help describe it?
There's some comments, but it's a lot of. I was talking with Will about this last week. It was like, the code is both very elegant, the sort of the abstractions are very elegant. There's a kind of deep elegance in the design. And at the same time, the code is like a total mess that is like would just kind of make people run and scream, in part because a lot of it was translated from assembly to C, right? So it's like, it's kind of the idiom of it. But at the same time, that also can have its own elegance too.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in there that like the original Commodore 64 assembly code was lost, you know, even prior to the big fire that destroyed Will Wright's house.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So like they didn't even have the original source code to like refer back to. They just had the, sort of the program itself.
That's right. Well, they ported it. So when they released they did the Mac, Amiga, PC versions, Will rewrote the simulator in C, and then the other programmer sort of built the UI and the rest of it. Software okay. around it. But then they wanted to release, then the game became a hit. They wanted to release it for more platforms. Then they wanted to release the C64 version, but they didn't have the assembly code for it anymore. That had been lost. So I guess, yeah, in there, it's somewhere in that transition. It's gone. I forget the specific path lost, but then they want to modify the title screen because it wasn't called SimCity yet. So they don't have the code for it. So they have to go in and modify the machine code and like patch in the, you know, the proper SimCity title graphic.
Figure out exactly where in the code the city planner title was at, and just like swap it out. Exactly. Sounds miserable.
Yeah, but the beautiful thing about it from a historical standpoint is that the Commodore 64 version then gives you like a glimpse at what the prototype for SimCity was before it became SimCity. So, because really, it's it's not the same. You know, like it's like it shares a lot in common, and like the core, the heart of it is like there in a sense, but it's a different beast. So you get this snapshot into the design evolution of SimCity, the development of it.
Yeah, this really makes me want to check out the Commodore 64 version just to like get an experience of like what was SimCity between being SimCity and being just like the dev tools for a raid on Bungling Bay.
Yes, yes, totally.
Which I did like how you like laid out the description of like how Bungling Bay's systems work, because I knew like, okay, yeah, like I knew this is how this led to SimCity. I knew that there's like stuff going on in the background that the like the like enemy bases build up over time, but you were able to sort of like draw out like this is how this whole thing works, even though you don't actually see it, and that may have played against the game's like reception. But I thought that was really like interesting how that comes together and like that sort of interconnection between the two games.
Yeah, there's a great Will Wright did a GDC talk, a post retro. What do they call them? Retro. They have these retro
retrospectives. I don't remember retro what they
post-mortem.
Call them.
It's like a vintage postmortem, something like that.
That's
not what it's called, but something like that. And they did want to write on Bungling Bay, and that's where a lot of that material came from. And then I was like, oh yeah, you can see him kind of like working his way towards SimCity, not just with like the level editor, but also his sensibility as a designer with the simulation logic. And then also the struggle with the kind of user interface, like where he's like, it didn't work. And then this people didn't see what was happening. And then the C64 version of SimCity, it's like really awkward, you know, but you can see it kind of groping its way towards the GUI. And then once it gets on the Mac, it's like, now I can really breathe.
Now I've got a mouse.
Right. I've got a mouse. It really helps.
It sure does. Jeez.
So, interesting tidbit. When I was corresponding with Nintendo and Miyamoto's team, like through like some channels, like to get into some of the Maxis Nintendo stuff, and they were like giving me a lot of really nice information. And one of the things that Miyamoto said is that. One of the things he was most proud of, I got the sense of, was figuring out how to make the mouse controls work on the console. Like that was like one of the things that was like this key, you know, he remembered that as like one of the key things that they figured out that he seemed proud of.
You mentioned there's like a good chunk of this that had to be like cut out because it didn't really work with the narrative and the word count. Yeah. Like, are there any particular like stories or like anecdotes or even just general like data that you thought were really interesting that you couldn't fit in there other than like the Lucas bit?
I mean, there's so much. Oh my gosh. What's another one that I've got is like Sim Earth. So James Lovelock, who's the co-inventor of the Gaia theory, like, you know, which is basically Earth system science.
Yeah, with a silly name.
Yeah. He collaborated with Will. So he helped with SimEarth, and then Stuart Brand helps connect them. I mean, there's like the connections here are just fascinating. Stuart Brand, who was involved in the New Games movement and created the Horth catalog. And then I was talking, and Lovelock in his memoir, his book, he says that Maxis gave royalties for SimEarth back to them, which helped his nonprofit keep going, which I write about in the book. But then I asked Will about it, and he was like, no, he's like, I don't think so. But I found the documentation that proves that Lovelock is correct. He's like, Will didn't remember that. But he's like, but I do remember that we had in the registration card for SimEarth, you could choose a nonprofit for us to donate $1 to. So you'd register, you'd send them the registration card, you'd check off your thing. So Maxis got your registration info, and then they would donate $1 to a nonprofit. And initially they had... Will said they didn't do their research carefully, but they had Earth First on there, which is like a sort of radical eco-terrorist group of some kind. Maybe I'm being overly harsh, but you can read the Wikipedia yourself. But he says they got a lot of blowback from that, and they had to change that. And then then Phil saw, I was asking, but I couldn't find I needed to verify the story. I wanted to get like another data, I wanted to validate that story. So I was looking for registration cards, and the registration card I have in the copy of Sim Earth I have here does not have Earth First. And then I asked Phil Salvador at Video Game History Foundation, and then he contacted an archivist at the Strong Museum, and they have an early copy of Sim Earth that did in fact have that card. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But there's so many, there's a whole book of what isn't in the book. So yeah.
Oh yeah, I know Phil is a big Maxis person, and I saw when you were writing about the Maxis business simulations, I'm like, I know where some of this came from.
Totally Phil's work. Yeah. I mean, I think he really just kind of cracked that open for me. I was like, I never really got the scope of it and the import of it. That was super helpful. And then when I talked to the venture capitalists who invested in Maxis, that then helped me get the context for the Maxis business simulations. It's like, oh, because it's like, that's why Maxis got VC funding at all, was to basically do that line of work.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think it's always really cool when folks go outside of just interviewing, game developers and talking to some of the executives and the marketers and the folks funding these things. Get their perspectives, because those are historically important too, and they help get you that fuller picture.
Totally.
Because technically developers, they're just they don't really know what they're doing, and then everyone else is like, what the heck are the developers doing?
Totally. No, I think it's the developer. I remember that from EA, we'd be like, all of us would be like, what? We have to ship Spore on the Wii now? We have to run a console first at some point? It's like, who's making these decisions? Well, it's like, actually, who are these knuckleheads? And it's like, no, they're not knuckleheads, actually. They're actually the people that managed to run, because especially you think about how many game companies collapse. It's like, there's people that are thinking about how to run a game company and make it work as a business, not just as a creative endeavor, right? So it's like, you got to have that mix, which is one of the things that I really got attuned to writing this book was that. And of course, I know as I'm more on the development side, I'm trying to build up my business muscles. Do you know the GameCraft podcast? It's so good. Can I pitch it for a minute? I'm just going to not listen for your answer. I'm just going to go.
Go for it.
it's hosted by two venture capitalists who do games. But one of them, Mitch Lasky, has been a games executive for decades. And so it's a history of video games from the perspective of business. And it's really good. And part of what I love about it is that they may say things like, the last thing you should do when you make a game is innovate in game design, because you're just taking an unnecessary business risk. And I'm just like, oh, I love it. These guys are so smart, and they think completely differently than me, and I have a lot to learn from them.
Yeah, it's very strange that a business that's so diametrically opposed on both ends has managed to muddle through and become so large for over the past few decades. I guess it's not too different from the movie industry in that regard, huh?
Yeah, totally. And actually, and Deer Hunter, there's some games and some some bits of game history and the rise of casual gaming that just do not make sense unless you have the business context and talk to the business executives. And that's part of what I got out of listening to that.
Yeah, the Big Buck Hunter games, all of those golf arcade games that still float around in bars and such.
Yeah, it's like a buyer. It was like a buyer at Walmart or something like that who was kind of initiated a lot of that. It's a wild story.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and seeing that and then also reading about, games like Sim Earth and Sim Ant, which are super cool, super interesting games. I love basically everything about them. And they just flopped, but Jeff Braun was like, you know what? We got to let Will Wright cook. And we'll see what he comes up with. And it just, as it turns out, that is not a good business model either. So
yeah,
finding that balance is not something I think a lot of people are very good at. And the ones who are, they are in demand.
And that's the saga of The Sims. I think that's part of what makes it such a juicy story to follow, is that the business, kind of the management and business side of Maxis versus the creative side of Maxis struggling with it for many years. And even EA also, but it eventually finds it, like threads the needle and it finds its way through.
Yeah. And the Maxis business stuff just is extremely like fascinating. It's like, yeah, being the source of the venture capitalist funding makes a lot of sense why they even did that stuff. But it's also like fascinating because you sort of lay out like, yeah, these people looked at SimCity, you know, and were like, we could use this to like train people to do stuff. And they're like, well, no, you can't, but I see where your head's at. And Maxis sees a business opportunity and gives it a whirl.
I don't know. I guess I do spend some of my time like as a developer or designer doing building those kind of things. I do think there is a space for kind of like learning simulations or simulations that teach things, but it seems like it's not like a cracked kind of business strategy or something, how to do it or something. I don't know. There's something there, but I think the thing that wasn't there for Maxis was that you couldn't like just, it wasn't like an easy pivot for Maxis to do business simulations. And in fact, so William Janeway is the VC who was pushing for Maxis business simulations, and he saw this kind of enterprise simulation market. And then his partner, Henry Kressel, when I talked to him, he's like, I always kind of thought that it really wasn't a compatible business, but he was really interested in the education side of it, you know, the kind of, so what Henry was saying is that, he's like, yeah, it always seemed like it was a bit more like a kind of consulting business to do that kind of work, which is very different than packaged goods. It's like a really different kind of business operation.
Yeah, like I agree that you can use like SimCity as an educational tool, and I think some of Maxis's other Sim stuff very much could work in that vein. It's just like, I don't know that you could use it as necessarily like a professional development necessarily, at least SimCity. I will say SimAnt taught me a lot about ants as a kid.
Likewise.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like, you don't really touch it on, like, some of the saga of some of that stuff. Like, Sim Health, in particular, just has a very strange history that's very much in a political moment.
Yes, and, totally. Go read Phil's stuff. But yeah, that's, like, I think, again, that's, like, I think there's, like, books to be written about Maxis, and I think that in the book length Maxis, you'd get one day. I'm not writing any more books.
I was going to ask if you have another one in you after that. I guess not.
No, definitely not. Definitely against it for the time being. Not like I regret it, but just like that was a lot.
I need a break. I need to do something else.
Yeah.
So what sort of stuff are you working on at this point? Now that you've got this book wrapped up and you're doing things other than that.
Yeah, I mean the main thing is, I guess right now we can come back to our water conversation. I'm working with some collaborators on a interactive simulation for learning that's about water dynamics. And so I have these really cool collaborators who were working on a tool that is all about helping people think about and make decisions about how to plant trees in urban environments to like get more, to like waste less water. So like, you know, cause there's a ton of like in Los Angeles, like a ton of rain comes down and it's all channeled off in the LA River, which is a giant, you know, concrete thing. It just kind of gets, so it's like, you need, this is a place and that needs a lot of water, and it has a lot of rain, but it's all kind of thrown away. So how do you modify the environment so you're getting, so you're, you know, keeping that water and using it? So I was like, I had this insight recently. I was like, let's use like a falling sand sim, you know, like to like try to like make some of this stuff like fun and engaging and informative. So that's one project I've been doing this last month. But
you can't escape the simulation realm.
Yeah, I mean, I love it. So that's part of it. Is I guess like in my own work, I just kind of love I love toys. I love making toys. I love making simulation toys. So, and I also like learning about the real world, you know, so it's like an excuse to do all those things at the same time, I guess.
So SimCity sort of factors into your career in that regard too, sort of like you played it as a kid and now here you are as an adult.
Totally. That's totally true. Yeah, I think that's part of why I wrote a lot of this book too, because it is relevant to my life as a designer, and especially that analog simulation stuff.
Which I'd never heard of before reading this book, and that was just like very, very interesting. It's like, oh yeah, I guess they would have had to have like simulations and stuff before like digital computers were doing it, but.
Yeah, totally. And those things, and actually, that's one thing. When I talked to Bob Albrecht, who we talked about, you know, was one of the basic proselytizers. You know, I think it was in the 70s, he did programming on analog computers. So these analog machines are still around, even and they overlap with digital machines. And so I wasn't sure. I recently got an email. I need to respond from Ken Karakotsis, who's the author of Sim Life. And I'd interviewed him at one point for the book. And he was like, oh, you know, he told me that he really enjoyed the book. And he really liked that chapter on analogs, which was very gratifying. Cause I'm like, this is a very, like, feels like a very deep cut kind of chapter. That's like, I was like, this is really for me, you know, like, and people that are like designing these interactive simulations and really want to think about like cognition and, you know, what it means to use one kind of material to represent, we use one kind of substance like electricity to model another kind of substance like a bridge, you know, like to me I'm like, this is like the, this is the juiciest, it's catnip. Yeah, for me it's catnip. I'm like, I don't know who else is gonna be catnip for. I tried to make it really accessible and I hope I did, but the fact that Ken was like, I really like that, I was like, cool, another simulation nerd is like really into this. So yes. I think I did it.
Yeah, I know. In sort of my day job, we do have simulators here and there, like model out water flows and levels under different conditions. So yeah, that sort of thing is very interesting to me. Obviously, one of their Max's Business things that didn't really go anywhere was Sim Environment, which I don't remember if you like name drop that one or not. I think you did.
I think I tried to list the names of them at least, yeah, to kind of get the, yeah.
Yeah, but that one obviously didn't go anywhere either. And like, but hearing about that one, I'm like, oh yeah, that would be kind of neat if that was like a Sim City like style program. Oh well,
totally. Well, what would be in your Sim environment? Because there's like many, there's so many different environmental.
Well, you gotta
have topics you could tackle.
Gotta have your water like pollution. You gotta like factor in. I think you could factor in like a climate model of some sort, like one of the potential paths, like for changing conditions.
Yes.
You have to deal with like the historical conditions if you're talking about like a real place, like it's a scenario. Otherwise, you could probably just sort of define that. However, I don't know. I think it'd be interesting. I think there is a game there. I don't know that anyone's going to make it. I mean, who knows? It's a world of indie games these days that I can't keep up with. But
it may exist.
It might exist.
I mean, hearing you say this, I'm just realizing that SimCity doesn't have that stuff in it, but it does have Godzilla, which in some way is a kind of shorthand, quote Godzilla, right? Like, it's not Godzilla, but...
It's illegally and medically distinct from Godzilla.
Yeah, exactly. it has Godzilla, which is like, isn't Godzilla's story that he's sort of he's like the nuclear fallout in a sense, but yeah, it's like made kind of like this personification of environmental ills. So in a sense, it's like SimCity has it, but in this very playful, abstracted way. It's not at all like what you're saying, but like it's like it does it by not doing it in this way.
Yeah, I mean, you could just set it to like cause disasters very frequently, and you're like, there you go. It's the really bad climate change track if we're going the wrong way.
I'm thinking about plagues, like the 10 plagues, like in the Passover story. Like you have like giant locusts come. Like what if it was just SimCity? The environmental disasters were just things like that.
Raid of Godzillas over the land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of wraps up questions I had for this. Do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to discuss on this book, on this topic, before we call it?
I think that was great. I remember one other tidbit that I wanted to mention.
Yeah, go
which
for it.
May or may not be true, but about the Godzilla, as I was talking, because like, there's the on the cover of the original SimCity box, there's the Godzilla quote. There's the giant monster. Sorry, who's not Godzilla? And actually, I am told by multiple sources that I think are reliable that actually it was not Godzilla, but it was another monster that kind of was like Godzilla-like, like actually. But then it was replaced by the tornado after Toho came after Maxis. Now, there's a video from 1993 in the SimCity 2000 or mid-2000s. You can see it on YouTube of Will Wright talking about SimCity. It's like for the CD-ROM edition of SimCity 2000. You can see the Godzilla. Sorry, the monster doll next to him. So there it is. It's kind of like, where's the doll, right? That's the question. And then I was talking to Maxis's former general counsel, and he was saying that he has the doll, which totally makes sense, actually, because he's the one who helped defend Maxis to negotiate with him, with the Toho lawyers. And he says it's in a storage unit somewhere. So, you know, I don't know if all that's true, but it would make sense. So somewhere, it's somewhere out there.
We need to get that doll to the Strong Museum.
Yeah, exactly.
An important piece of Max's history.
I did make an introduction, I think. I don't think it went anywhere.
Well, someday, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. This has been Retronauts, a Patreon-supported show, patreon.com/retronauts. If you want to subscribe to us at the $3 level, you get each episode 1 week early and at a higher bit rate. And at the $5 level, you also get access to Friday bonus episodes twice a month, Diamond Fight's weekly columns every Sunday, and the Retronauts Discord server. So that keeps us going. And if you back us already, thank you very much. And if not, please consider doing so. And where can we find you?
My website is chaim.io, or you can go to, for the book, the book is Building SimCity. You can go to buildingsimcity.com or simcitybook.com, and that'll take you to the MIT Press page.
We'll see if we can link it in the show notes as well. Okay. And yeah, where can people buy your book?
Anywhere books are sold, I think like, Amazon, Barnes and Noble. I think right now it's mainly, I think it may be only online. So if you go to the MIT Press page, you'll find the links to the different stores that have it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And as for me, I'm on Blue Sky at Ugrisaurus. You can also find my book. I did do a book, Atari Archive Volume 1. You can find that on Amazon and through Limited Run Games. And I also produce the Atari Archive YouTube series, sort of delving into the history of early video games through the lens of the Atari 2600 library. So if that interests you, check it out as well. And with that, I think we'll sign off. Thank you very much for listening.